spent last week with many of you at our wonderful church retreat. And while on the shores of Lake Tahoe with MPC last week, I had a Bible with me. Now, I only mention this because our guest speaker, who is a Catholic priest, somehow assumed that all Protestants would, quote, show up on time with a Bible in hand, according to some joke about the difference between Catholics and Protestants. He quickly found out that MPCers did neither, though he was able to coax a little bit of our Bible knowledge out using charades and hand gestures. Anyway, I was among the minority of retreat growers who had brought a Bible with them. Now, it turns out that the Bible I had was a children's Bible, a Today's English Version or Good News Version Bible. This is a Bible with a limited vocabulary appropriate to a smart 8-year-old or perhaps appropriate to someone learning English as a second language. It's a responsible translation, but it's really rather simple. Seeing that I needed to prepare a sermon, I could, of course, have asked one of the hotel dwellers to spot me a Gideon's Bible instead, or even better, I could have used the NRSV Bible app on my phone had I had sufficient electricity to keep it charged in the woods, but I decided to commit. So I went ahead with the Good News Bible version. Does it not say, after all, that if one is to enter the kingdom, one must do so as a little child? Anyway, in researching today's sermon using the Children's Bible, I was delighted to find a really nice quirk of translation in the lines leading up to today's reading. In the chapter before Michael read today, the chapter that Ben preached on last week, it said that God had charged Paul with the work of helping people become friends of God. Now, a Bible that allows more complicated words would have said that Paul's work was the ministry of reconciliation, and those are the words you'll find in your pew Bible, but I really like those words. The work of helping people become friends with God. Reconciliation is a rich word, but I too often go to technical interpretations like you reconcile a budget. I know what it means, but it's complicated. The idea of friendship is rich too, and simpler, somehow easier to grasp, even though a friendship is by no means an easy thing in real life. And according to the 4th century saint, Gregory of Nyssa, the only thing that truly matters is becoming friends with God. A lofty and mysterious goal, but an important one. Those of us who are at Tahoe together spent a week building deeper relationships with one another and deepening our relationships with the community of God's creation, the trees and plants and flowers and birds, and I hope in some mysterious way, through our prayer, our song, our conversation, I hope we were also somehow making friends with God. Now, in the age of Facebook, the word friend has lost a lot of its punch, but friendships really are important. It takes more work than clicking follow to maintain a deep friendship. And you don't have to agree about everything with your friend, but it's really important to work through your disagreements and stay in touch. That's the work of friendship. And I found that the best friendships I have right now are the ones that have a built-in structure of commitment. For example, a weekly dinner or monthly coffee date. Because it can be so hard to schedule friend time in the midst of such a busy life. Now, if you think about being friends with God, the good thing is you don't have to make an appointment because God is always available at a moment's notice. But for the sake of your side of the friendship, it might be good to have some standing appointments or ways to stay in touch. Structures and channels for communication can make such a difference in a friendship. My husband and I text one another through the day on a regular basis. Sometimes it's a sentence or more about what's happening, and sometimes it's just an emoji or a selfie. It's nice to have that ongoing relationship, that ongoing conversation. It keeps our relationship strong. And in the same way, some people try to have an ongoing conversation with God in our minds, or ongoing appointments to maintain the relationships. For example, committing to try to go to church on Sunday, like you all are here, or trying to pray before each meal keeps us connected on a daily basis. And I think the word friendship is key in reading the book of Corinthians, because the core issue facing the church at Corinth was their relationship, their friendship, if you will, not just with God, but also with the Apostle Paul. Were they still friends with Paul, or were some other apostles getting in the way? Was their relationship damaged by his long absence while he visited other cities? Did they still trust him, or did Paul have to prove himself again? It's relatable because many of us have experienced relationships that were strained by distance, or think about coming back to school in September after summer vacation and not being sure if your friends are still your friends. Now, imagine holding a relationship open-hearted across the distance when you didn't have text messaging or emails, not even phone calls, not even landlines, not even a reliable mail service. The letters that make up the skinny last section of the Bible were carried by hand or on horse or on a boat. Imagine trying to keep up a friendship with letters carried a few times a year. Imagine how easy it would be to be sidetracked by rumors or gossip if you didn't have any face-to-face time to counteract those. Here, Paul is trying to help build a stronger communion between his people and the Corinthians, that is, to reconcile their relationship, to fix their friendship. And he does this in a way by pointing to their mutual friend, their relationships with God through Christ. And it's not just like meeting someone new through a mutual friend and you know, where you say, well, if you're a friend of Barbara's, I'm sure I like you already. It's not just like that. It's even more. He's reminding the Corinthians that they are all committed to the same cause. They are actively working for the same community, that they care about the same things. At chapter 6, verse 3, the Children's Bible reads, "We do not want anyone to find fault with our work, so we try not to put obstacles in any way. Instead, in everything we do, we show that we are God's servants." Basically, Paul's reminding them, we're on the same team. We're doing everything we can for God and for you. Paul's telling them he is their ally. And the list that follows, troubles, hardships, difficulties, being beaten, jailed, and mobbed, and being overworked and going without food or sleep, this list proves that the alliance is not an easy one. It comes at a cost, measurable in persecution. Paul was doing a difficult thing. He was being a Christian preacher in a world that did not recognize Christianity as valid. And then Paul goes on to list what my fancy study Bible in the office here would call antitheses, but the Children's Bible would simply call opposites. A lot of contradicting things happened to Paul and his people. We are honored and disgraced at the same time. We are insulted and we are praised. We are treated as liars, but we speak the truth. We are treated as though we were dead, but look, we're alive. We seem poor, but we make many people rich. We seem to have nothing, but really, we have everything. These opposites remind us of the deep truth that things are usually not what they seem. They remind us of some of the deepest things Jesus said, like give away everything to be truly rich, or blessed are they that mourn, blessed are the hungry. These contradictions remind us that God's truth, the truer reality, is sometimes the opposite of what people see on the outside. As we learn to follow Christ, we learn to live with the contradictions, to live inside a paradox. And this weekend, as thousands upon thousands of people are marching in pride parades across the world, I want to lift up the witness of some faithful people who really know what it's like to live with contradictions. And I'm talking particularly now about those transgender people who identify as non-binary or genderqueer, gender non-conforming or gender flexible, those who occupy the space in between the two commonly accepted genders, those who are a third gender, or a fourth, or another one entirely. Note, please, that this is not about your biological sex. You might be intersex, or you might be biologically male or female, but gender identity is about what really fits your sense of self, whether you feel like you truly are a man or a woman or something else. My friends have a child who is exploring their gender, and when asked, "So what word should we use for you? Should we say he? Should we say she? Should we say they?" The child's answer has often been, "A million and three." The technical word for that kind of gender expression would be gender expansive. This young child wants it all, male and female and everything in between. Once you accept that there's something beyond the man and woman box, you know, those check one or the other for the TSA, once you accept that there's something more than that, you realize that there really are a lot of options out there. Now, gender identity can be compared sometimes to a pair of socks. Bear with me, this sounds really trivial, but think about it. If your socks fit you right, you put them on, and you don't think about them again until you take them off. They disappear from your awareness because they fit right. So if you're cisgendered like I am, that means if your understanding of your gender matches the biological sex assigned to you at birth, if you're cisgendered, then you probably never thought about your gender identity. It wasn't part of your awareness because it fit. But think about it. If your socks just don't fit you right one day, if the socks rub and hurt you, you can hardly stop thinking about your feet and fussing with your socks and stopping to adjust them and pulling them up again and maybe wearing Band-Aids if you end up blistering. So to extend that metaphor, transgender people may have been given a pair of socks, that is, assigned a gender identity that just didn't fit, bothered them, and caused them pain, even while other people walked around in perfectly comfortable socks. If your assigned gender doesn't fit you, maybe you're able to identify this pain and some people just find another pair of socks, that is, another gender identity that does fit. Sometimes it fits perfectly. But you might also try on the other pair and find that it doesn't fit either. So, I don't know, a custom pair of socks might be called for, or maybe just forget the socks and go barefoot instead. So maybe you'll find a gender identity that's androgynous, you know, kind of in the middle, or maybe you'll just mix and match expansively, like a million and three. It takes a lot of faith and courage to live out the identity that God has called to you when it doesn't fit in one box or the other, and when others judge you and insist your experience and even your sense of self is not valid. So I want to lift up the faithful witness of transgender people today, not just because they're teaching us to resist putting everything into the either or opposite pairs, but because I think they have a lot in common with the Apostle Paul's experience. Paul and the early Christians were trying to live out a new religion that was not accepted as valid. It was not, at that time, yet on the Roman list of, quote, acceptable religions. And it was rejected by Jewish leaders as a distortion of the true Jewish faith. And everywhere they went, they faced the painful consequences of this rejection. And today, even though we're still making so much progress in learning to accept one another, people who do not conform to the gender binary, who refuse to present or to pass as either a man or a woman, they still face enormous amounts of harassment and often are not accepted as valid. Yet so many continue to live their fabulous lives and disrupt our sense of either or and expand our worldviews and liberate us all from these narrow gender roles. When you're experiencing persecution, for your religion or your gender or anything else, friendships become extra important. When things get tough, it matters to know that there are people by your side. Whether they're right there with you and you can hold their hand, or whether they're sending you letters from across land and sea. And I think this is why Paul implores the Corinthians so heartfeltly, please, let's stay on the same team. Don't let our distance separate us. Don't let the rumors get in the way. Paul needs their friendship. Our heart is wide open to you, he calls across the miles. Dear children, please open wide your hearts also. This same call extends to us today. Open wide your hearts. God wants your friendship, and there are people today who desperately need your friendship. And these things come together. Because if you become friends with God, you enter a social circle that includes a lot of people who are suffering. Being God's friend might mean that you might show up at the protests at ICE detention centers next weekend. It might have to mean that you spend time, precious time, reaching out to someone who's been suffering under harassment and bullying. Being God's friend might mean writing long letters to faraway people, like Paul did, encouraging them and assuring them across the miles that no matter how long they are separated from you, you are still on their team. You still send your love. So open your hearts and open them wide. As Paul begged the Corinthians, so we must beg one another today. Open your hearts wide. Be a friend, and especially a friend to those in need. Let God's love flow through you and move you and change you. And enjoy, friends, enjoy the liberation that this brings. Amen.